There are more than 600 certified organic farms in Iowa and many other farms using sustainable and organic practices. This hour, organic farming, the challenges of certification, and the importance of biodiversity. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The 15th annual Iowa Organic Conference is coming up November 22nd and 23rd. Today, we'll find out what's involved in organic or sustainable meat production from Doug Darrow, owner of Rapid Creek Ranch, and Ty Gustafson, owner of Story City Meat Locker. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Andy Dunham of Grinnell Heritage Farms and pollinator specialist Sarah Fultz-Jordan about plantings that attract native pollinators. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The number of certified organic farms in Iowa is rising rapidly. There are now over 600. The number of farms using organic or sustainable practices without certification is even higher and rising faster. This hour, we'll talk to farmers, producers, and researchers who are doing the work. The 15th annual Iowa Organic Conference is coming up on November 22nd and 23rd in Iowa City. It's a joint conference sponsored by Iowa State University Extension and the University of Iowa Office of Sustainability. This year's theme is celebrating the biodiversity of organic farming. And this hour, we're going to talk to a number of people who'll be presenting at the conference, and we're going to start with a look at organic or sustainable meat production. My first guest today is Doug Darrow. He's owner of Rapid Creek Ranch near Oxford. Hello, Doug.
How are you, Charity?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yep. You're welcome.
Now, describe for us a little bit about your operation.
All right. Well, about 5 years ago, we decided that we were done trying to raise corn in the commodity sector, and get off the treadmill, as it were. We've been raising beef cattle in our area, on our farm, since we moved here in 1989. I've been involved in the beef industry since the mid 70s, so I've got to see a lot of it. What we did about 5 years ago is, let me back up just a second. Since the mid 90s, we started intensively grazing our beef cow herd on our pastures, and then at the end of the season, then we would pull the calves, let the cows keep grazing out on corn stalks or dry lot them, as it were, and put the calves into the feed yard and then feed them out that way. Well, if you start putting a pencil to it, especially in today's markets, it doesn't work. We're not big enough. We don't have economy of scale on our farm, so I was in contact with a professor when I went to Kirkwood many, many years ago, and he said, well, why don't you sell it individually? So we started down that road of retail sales. And as we got going on that, our first shot at the Iowa City Farmers Market, I had a lovely, lovely little old lady and her husband come up to our booth and say, do you raise grass-fed beef? And we said, no, we don't. Our cattle are fed corn. And she said, oh, that's too bad, because if you had, I would buy all my beef from you. That struck a note. And then I began to research that a little bit. And not only for the health of the livestock, but for the health of the soil and how much healthier grass-fed beef is, I couldn't not explore it a little farther.
So that was a real watershed moment for you. What, beyond a woman saying, hey, if it was grass-fed beef, I'd buy it from you, what was it that really convinced you to make a change? Because that's a big change.
Well, you know, I raised six kids. Thank God they were all healthy and off and raising their own families now. And we were pretty, you know, real healthy. We had some sports injuries and that type of thing, but for the most part, really healthy. But I've always wondered why our society from the mid 70s, when I was coming of age, to today has gotten bigger and bigger. And I got to looking at that and then started to research our diet and realized that, wow, what we're eating is causing so much of the problems. And then when you can tie that to some of the diabetes, type 2 diabetes, obesity, that type of thing. And I was trying to figure out how what we eat every day it is not making us healthy. It's actually making us sick. So when I actually read the book Omnivore's Dilemma about 7 years ago, my daughter gave that to me for a Christmas present. That really opened my eyes. That was actually the watershed moment. That was what made me stop and take pause. And
now, Doug, you had been a conventional farmer for a long time. And when you decided you wanted to change how you were raising cattle, you chose not to go through organic certification. Why did you make that decision?
Well, I didn't. At the time, I was I researched it some, but it was more important to me that we stayed in a local, using the idea of local sustainability, meaning if I were going to feed grain, which we feed some grains to our poultry program, wouldn't it be smarter for me to buy a non-GMO grain from a local elevator or from my neighbor who's growing non-GMO grain and grind it myself versus having it shipped across the state? Now, that was a few years ago before I understood how accessible organics is getting. But to me, it just seems like if we can stay local and rebuild the community that we lost in agriculture over the past 40 years, that made more sense to me, I guess.
Tell me how your operation is different today. How do you raise your cattle?
We're actually still transitioning, if you can believe that, in 5 years. What I've learned over the last 5.5, 6 years is our genetics that we've worked with in our beef cows are not really set up for grass environment. So we actually had to search around. And as I did that, I started to find more and more people like myself. We started buying some genetics that are 100% grass-based. We're reducing the size of our beef cows because they're just too big, and they're more geared towards the commodity industry where we used to take them off and then start pushing corn on them we would grow them out frame-wise and then finish them on grain. We could get that done in anywhere from 14 to 18 months. Now, grass feeding these cattle, we're looking for cattle that convert sunlight grass to beef, and it takes just a little bit longer. We're up in the, some of these bigger framed cattle that we've got are actually finishing closer to 34 months, where we're with grass-based genetics, we're hoping to be back down into the 20-month, 24-month range. So, that being said, these cattle are designed or genetically worked to convert grass better. And being how they're smaller, they can get to a marketable weight faster than what I call commodity beef. So,
you also, I know you keep your calves with their mothers longer than most people do in conventional operations. Tell me about that.
Right. Well, some of the things I've been observing is if we can mimic nature with our cow herd, similar to how the buffalo or elk would work in the past, even the buffalo herds, there was nobody that segregated the calves. There was nobody that segregated the calves from the cows and then let them get over the anxiety,
right,
and then put them back. So essentially what we've done is we're just going to leave everything out there. The cows may be given a very, very small amount of milk in the winter months, maybe half a cup, high fat, obviously, for the calves, and the cow will actually wean the calf. Now, from a management standpoint, we have to be very selective about what kind of cows. We're watching them every day. So if she starts to lose condition and that type of thing, we know that she's not going to work in this environment. So we'll get her pulled off and then send her to town and, let somebody that wants to haul corn corn silage every day, feed her, you know. So the idea that the calves are left on the cows is they become family units in a sense, in that just like most herd animals, there's a hierarchy, but they all kind of take care of each other. Now, I've not seen it yet, but I've been told by a friend of mine that does this in Missouri that you actually notice that a first calf heifer will be having her first calf, and she may have an aunt or a sister or her mother will come by at calving time. And I don't know whether there's moral support to cattle or not, but it's kind of a neat concept. It gets back more to nature than and letting nature drive this.
Right. The herd is made up of animals that are related to each other, not just animals that are penned together.
Correct. And, you know, we've got 180 acres of pasture, plus we rent some corn stalks and that type of thing in the winter months. But it just seems that the cattle are calmer. They seem to be healthier, which makes it a lot easier on me. So I'm calmer and I'm healthier. So
you've also worked chickens into your operation. How did that come about?
That's correct. After reading Omnivore's Dilemma, I was introduced to Joel Salatin, who is kind of a, I don't know what you want to call it, but he basically designed this model over 40 years where he runs his cattle, and then he'll run laying hens directly behind his cows. And everybody said, well, what do you know, all that work for those eggs? And I said, well, you know, that's true, and the eggs are basically a real nice byproduct. But the actual intent of the chickens or the laying hens behind the cows is to clean the pasture. They're my sanitizing crew. So if you can imagine, and I know this may sound a little weird, but chickens eat bugs and they eat larvae and they eat whatever they can. They're pretty non-selective when it comes to something to eat. So, but if you understand the life cycle of a horn fly or a face fly, it's about 3 days, and that's usually laid in the cow pads. And in about 3 days, they start to hatch, and then they grow into mature flies, and they're overbothering the cows. So what we do is try to keep the chicken bus with all the laying hens about 3 days behind the cows, so that when we let them out for the day, they can go anywhere on the farm they want, but they stay pretty close to the bus because that's where they eat. And that's
well,
where
and
they sleep.
We're going to have to take a break, Doug, but we'll be back in just a moment, and I've got to ask you more about your chicken bus. That sounds unusual. We will get back to this conversation. I'm talking with Doug Darrow, owner of Rapid Creek Ranch near Oxford. Coming up in a moment, we'll also talk about processing meat in an organic or sustainable way with Ty Gustafson of Story City Meat Locker. This hour, we're talking with people who are involved in the 15th Annual Iowa Organic Conference, which is coming up in Iowa City, November 22nd and 23rd. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The 15th Annual Iowa Organic Conference is coming up November 22nd and 23rd in Iowa City. It's a joint conference sponsored by Iowa State University Extension and the University of Iowa Office of Sustainability. You can find out more information about the conference on our Facebook page, or you can follow a link on Twitter as well. This hour, we are running with the theme of the conference and talking to a number of people who will be presenting. The theme this year is celebrating the biodiversity of organic farming, and right now we're focusing on meat production. With me, Doug Darrow, owner of Rapid Creek Ranch near Oxford, and we were talking about a little of the diversity on your farm just before the break, Doug. So you raise cattle, but then you also brought in chickens to kind of sanitize the field after the cattle have been grazing in that pasture, and I've heard people talk about chicken tractors, but you mentioned a chicken bus. Is this literally a bus?
Yes, it is a charity. It's actually we found it from a rag by group that were upgrading their bus up north of Ames, and my son Justin went up and got it, brought it home, and we took all the seats out and we put nest boxes down one side, and we put perches on the other side, and that's what they call their their summer quarters. So they. Takes about a week for them to get trained going on the bus. And Generally, that's the last thing I do in the evening during the summer when the sun goes down around 9:30. But now it's kind of nice because I'm back at the house before supper now, because shortly after dark, they're all on the bus.
Nice.
And the idea with that is that we can keep them close. We did start out. I mean, this has all been an evolution. We started out, we built a tractor schooner originally out of PVC. And, it gets a little windy here in Iowa. And that blew across the farm.
Oh, no.
So we tried a couple of hay racks, and that worked well. But the wind also got those. So we figure that if the wind blows the bus over, then it wasn't meant to be. So far, so good.
All right. So you've got laying hens, but you also do broilers as well. So raise chickens for meat also, right?
Correct. Now, the idea with the hens is to keep the pastures clean. And the broilers project is we use them because of the nutrient composition of their manure is very high. So if we have a weak spot on the farm soil-wise, we'll try and run those birds over that. Now, a chicken tractor is a structure that's 10 feet wide and 12 feet long. And half of it's covered, and then the other half is open. And we put up to 70 birds in that, and they have a feeder in there. But that get moved every morning to fresh grass. So we move it about 12 feet every day. And those birds, after about 3 days, are all standing at the front of the cage ready to go on to fresh grass. But we figure that they're getting probably a third of their total ration picking through the grass. If the crickets are out or grasshoppers or whatever bugs they can find in that little 10 by 12 closure, that adds to their ration. We're using a hybrid bird, a high percentage of white meat, and we can have those birds turned out in about 8 weeks. Now we did try a brand new type of an enclosure that we think we like a little better. It's called a hoopie, and it's basically some cattle panels bent in an arc and wired together with a tarp over it. And the birds have a larger area to walk around on. It takes us about the same amount of time, maybe about 9 weeks with these birds, but they seem to be out moving around a little more because they've got, we use electric netting or poultry netting, they call it, for their enclosure. So they've got a lot more space to work in, but we can also almost triple the amount of birds that we can put in one group. And they all seem to be pretty happy, and they go underneath there at night if it's a cool night. And I've gone out there late in the evening, and they may be just outside the enclosure also. But that's one of the things about that can be an issue that we solved with Buddy and Marley, our two guard dogs. We just put them in the pen with them, and Buddy and Marley, that's where they hang out for about 9 weeks.
Okay. So they keep them safe from predators.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, we'll lose a few, but not like if we'd have just let them out there and expected it to work. So.
Right. Well, Doug, I'm talking with Doug Darrow, owner of Rapid Creek Ranch. We've been talking about his operation where he raises cattle and chickens and laying hens. And I want to bring someone else into the conversation here because, of course, being a sustainable meat producer in Iowa, part of the process is processing that meat for market. And you have to do that locally as well. And that can bring up some interesting challenges also. So with me now is Ty Gustafson. He's the owner of Story City Meat Locker. Hello, Ty.
Morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me. And how you doing, Doug?
Real good, Ty, and yourself?
Doing well.
Now, you process meat for small growers. Tell me what you do for people.
Well, we've been open now for 2 years. And when we first started our business, we saw that there was a definite need for the small growers and people who raised niche meats and aiding them and getting their products to market. So, you know, when we opened, we thought that would be a small part of it, but we learned quickly that it's actually in high demand and something that we can help them with. So we, you know, are learning every day from our farmers that either raise different breeds or different practices and how they raise and feed their animals. And then what markets are in. We try and do different things like pricing tools to help them understand with the inputs they have into the animal, and then after processing what the value of that meat is when they're selling it in different markets or wholesale, those type of things. So we do as much as we can that the day allows for us to help these small growers be successful.
Is there more demand for what you do than you can meet?
Yes, I believe so. We have a lot of growers. I mean, Doug comes a long ways to bring his beef over to us. I imagine he would like it if there was someone like us closer to him that could do that. We have a lot of growers that are bringing things from all different corners of the state. And when we started our process, we had a lot of people tell us that our facility isn't big enough. The demand is larger than what we've scoped out. And we said, well, that's great, but we're not more is better type people. We want to provide a service and have a business of a certain size, and we've encouraged other people to start up similar type businesses to see if we can get more meat processing, small meat processing facilities throughout the state.
Now, you're not a certified organic processor.
We are not.
Okay. But you work with small producers. So can you tell me what's different about your process than the kind of process that conventionally raised cattle go through at a slaughterhouse and a meatpacking plant?
Well, for us, it comes down to the handling. We are AWA, animal welfare approved, in how we handle the animals. Do a lot of traceability, and we work with a lot of the farmers to have them come in. A lot of them come in to look at the carcasses aging in our cooler to understand what this one beef looks like compared to another beef, to know if they're feeding them the right way and are being most successful in what they're trying to do with their herds. We offer a lot of products that they are able to better resell when they're doing farmers markets and things like that, as well as we do what's called third-party labeling to help them do more branding with their products. So on the official labels that we label their packages with, it's got their farm name and possibly their logo on it, so that way they can brand themselves more with their customers.
You talked about having farmers come in and look at the meats that are raised in different ways. Can you look at beef and tell how it was raised?
It's definitely one of the obvious things is grass-fed versus corn-fed beef. That's easy to see the difference. Grass-fed beef will actually have a yellow tint to the fat that's on a carcass, and that has to do with its diet. But we have a lot of growers that, whether they're practicing organic practices or feeding only small grains, non-GMO, grass-fed only, all these different things, and purebred breeds of animals, or they're just very focused on the genetics like what Doug's doing and getting things that will perform well with that type of feeding that they want to do. So it's hard to say, you know, because we do custom process for local growers that are in the commercial market. So some confinement animals and things like that. And they're, you know, from one animal to the next, it is easy to see differences, but to know exactly what those differences are without knowing the farmer is difficult.
Now, you have chosen not to become organic certified. Why did you make that decision?
Well, we've had a few people ask us to become organic certified. And from our understanding, the processes that we do currently are organically approved. And the cost for organic certification is pretty high. And if we only have a couple of people asking for that as a business, we have to pass those costs along, and that would have been cost prohibitive for those producers. And with meat safety regulations around how you have to process when you're officially processing beef, officially processing pork, officially processing chickens, and then also have custom processing in there, as well as we process deer for local hunters, so that's wild game. And then you throw another layer of complexity on there with the organic certification and organic processing. It's just something as a business we chose that wasn't right for us now. Not that we won't ever do it, but currently the growers that we work with are really focused on their animals that they're raising, the way they're feeding them, and the market's demand that they have coming to them. Most people are looking for that traceability and to know the face of the farmer like Doug and things like that.
Now, you really built your business to be a large animal processing facility. So cattle and pigs, or what do you process?
We processed all the hoof species. So we do cattle, pork, lamb, and goat. Last year, in our first year of operations, we did process poultry. But being a large animal facility, the complexities of the testing, as well as the investment we had in the larger building for handling large animals, it was hard to make the numbers work with processing poultry. And through that process, we had a lot of customers that we didn't want to leave them high and dry. So we worked with some local people that were interested in just doing custom poultry, and we got them started, and we steered all of our customers locally to them to get their poultry processed that they needed just for themselves and their neighbors.
It seems like there is a lot of demand for what you do. Is this a shortage in Iowa?
I would say it is, and I would say it's going to be more of a shortage too as we move forward. If anybody's familiar with local processing, smaller facilities, there aren't too many new ones around. A lot of facilities are old and, you know, need some upgrades, or people are retiring out of that business. And that's why we had a lot of people that aided us in getting started and sharing information and specifications, and we want to share that forward with anybody else who's interested in doing it, because it's like farming. It's hard work, and you know, it's not something that everybody necessarily wants to do, but it's something that is rewarding, because we enjoy, on the small scale, working with all these different diverse farmers and their sustainability and what they're doing, and not doing the same thing over and over again. And we like learning every day from our farmers and finding out ways we can help them be successful too.
Well, and Doug, you and Ty obviously work together, so it makes sense that both of you have opted out of organic certification. But I'm curious, there has been a lot of growth in the local foods movement in Iowa, and there seems to be a lot of growth in the area of sustainability in addition to organic. Do you feel like you're part of a trend of farmers who are using sustainable practices and maybe even organic practices but are not pursuing certification?
I really do. I mean, I visited quite a bit with younger producers that have 40 acres that they bought themselves or inherited or part of the old homestead. We want to know what they can do with it, but they're very, very conscious about what they're going to do with the ground. They don't want to apply any chemicals in this, but as soon as they see what it's going to take to get certified, it's a bit overwhelming, because most of them are young people that may have grown up on the farm, left, and had come back, or used to go to grandma and grandpa's, or had an uncle or something that was on the farm, but they didn't live that life every day. So when you get up in the morning the first day and realize what it takes to get through the day, you start to throw on what it takes to become certified organic, it really becomes daunting. So I think that's part of the reason why we're seeing it this way.
Well, and Doug, of course, when you are certified organic, you can charge more for your product. But also when you communicate with your buyers and explain what you're doing, you can charge more for what you're doing than raising beef in a conventional way. Has this paid off for you, or is that organic label still tempting?
Actually, I think we're very satisfied with where we are. Most people that ask me about organic labeling aren't necessarily that concerned about it. They're more concerned about how the animals are treated, how they were raised. They want to come to the farm. That's one thing that we've always tried to do anytime we're talking over the table to somebody is, you're invited to my farm. Come out. It's better in the spring when there's a lot going on, but come to the farm. We'll walk around. I want to show you what's going on. You can see the calves with the cows. You can see the chickens in their hoopies. You can see how we raise and how we interact every day with our animals. And you happen to,
Doug,
if you go
we,
ahead.
We are nearly out of time, but I want to ask you before I let you go, how has changing how you raise your cattle and your chickens, how has that changed how you feel about what you do?
I'll tell you what, 5 years ago, before we made this transition, I was ready to line it all up and sell it. I'm very, very excited about agriculture again. And I'm very, very excited about young people getting into agriculture. 5 years ago, I would have told my kids to turn and run because there wasn't anything in it. Every year we worked, we worked hard all year, and if you broke even, it was a great year. Now I see an opportunity for a lot of young people to get into agriculture and make a living. It doesn't have to have 1,500 acres. You can make a pretty nice living on 50 or 60 acres if you manage it correctly and build your customer base and stay loyal to them as they're loyal to you.
Well, Doug, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're welcome.
Doug Darrow, owner of Rapid Creek Ranch near Oxford. Ty Gustafson, thank you.
Thank you.
Ty Gustafson, owner of Story City Meat Locker. We'll continue this conversation in a moment, inspired by the upcoming 15th annual Organic Iowa Organic Conference in Iowa City on November 22nd and 23rd. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, a conversation inspired by the upcoming 15th Annual Iowa Organic Conference. It's on November 22nd and 23rd in Iowa City, a joint conference sponsored by Iowa State University Extension and the University of Iowa Office of Sustainability. You can find out more about the conference on our Facebook page, or you can follow a link on Twitter at IPR Talk. And this year's theme is celebrating the biodiversity of organic farming. And of course, pollinators are incredibly important to farmers. But we're not just talking about honeybees. The ability to attract native pollinators can benefit a farmer in many ways. And with me now is Sarah Fultz-Jordan. She's a pollinator conservation specialist for the Great Lakes Region Xerces Society. Hello, Sarah.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And I'm going to introduce our farmer, Andy Dunham of Grinnell Heritage Farm here in just a moment, who's put a lot of ideas into practice on his farm as far as attracting pollinators. But I want to ask you first, okay, we've talked a lot about honeybees in the media. We've talked a lot about honeybees on Talk of Iowa and colony collapse disorder and all of the bad things that are happening to honeybees. But beyond honeybees, how important are native pollinators?
Right, yeah. And I will say that a lot of these declines in honeybees have driven more and more attention towards what's going on with our native bees, how important are they in crop pollination, and what's their status. And you can imagine it's a little bit harder to document declines in something like a native bee that has a really small nest size, and their nests are generally very dispersed. But we do know for one group of native bees, the bumblebees, which are our most charismatic native bee, they're sort of the teddy bear of the native bee world, we do have a good sense of their current status. And what we're seeing is that a quarter of our North American bumblebees are at risk of extinction today, and largely driven by a lot of the same threats that are important to honeybees, so things like habitat loss and pesticide exposure and disease. Not a very bright story,
no.
Especially for an insect that we are so reliant on, not only in our agricultural systems for crop pollination of things like tomatoes and blueberries and cranberries and lots of other crops, but also many of our natural ecosystems are really dependent on these insects as well.
Now, and of course, with honeybees, they can be bred and sold, and you can buy them, buy a whole colony and put it on your property. But with native pollinators, you can't do that. So what do you do to support and attract native pollinators?
Yeah, so the strategy to increase populations of native bees on your farm or in your landscape is really habitat-based. So I work a lot with growers across the Midwest who are interested in boosting these populations of native insects for their benefit to crop pollination and other services. And the idea is we come in and try to create or enhance habitat for these insects. And what these insects need includes foraging resources spring through fall, so simply flowers, and native flowers tend to be best. they also need nesting sites. So they don't, unlike the honeybees, you know, they don't nest in a hive. They nest in often in the ground. So they need protection from pesticides in soil. And then some of our native bees also nest in cavities, in stems, or in shrubs. And then, yeah, finally, another key habitat feature is that they are protected from pesticides.
All right. Well, I want to bring Andy Dunham into the conversation now. He's the co-owner of Grinnell Heritage Farms. And Andy, I know that you have done a lot to promote biodiversity on Grinnell Heritage Farms. How long have you been thinking about these native pollinators in the work that you do?
The native pollinators really for vegetable crops, which is what we tend to, you know, we grow more vegetable crops than fruit crops, are far more important than the honeybees are. Like, for example, there are native squash bees that are far more effective at pollinating squash blossoms than honeybees are. And so I started paying attention to this really before I even moved to Grinnell. And the more I learn, the more I realize I don't know. So it's really nice to be able to hear people like Sarah speak, because they really do lend insight to farmers for what we can do, you know, concrete examples of what we can do on our farms. So what we've been doing is exactly what Sarah kind of laid out, is providing more and more habitat. So for certified organic producers, we actually have a lot of things working in our favor for establishing bee habitat, because we're required to keep buffer strips around the periphery of our fields. And they tend to be, you know, about 30 feet wide. But if you widen that a little bit and put, you know, evergreen shrubs or something to catch the pesticide drift, and then on the inside of that you can plant, you know, more of your flowering shrubs and some of the native forbs and things. So, for example, on our north property line, we have thousands of native shrubs that bloom in the spring to provide pollen for the bees. And then we have a number of wildflower plantings that kind of come in a little bit after that. And then we try to time a lot of our cover crop plantings, which many organic farmers are already using a lot of cover crops effectively. So we let buckwheat, for example, bloom, which provides really nice, it's a really nice pollen source in the heat of the summer. Hairy vetch is another one. If you let that bloom, the bumblebees just love it. And as a consequence, we've noticed over the years that, for example, we can plant fewer squash plants, because more of our squash blossoms are being pollinated as our native bee populations increase.
Really? So you can really see a concrete difference, a cause and effect relationship there?
We can. One of the advantages of organic certification is that you have to keep copious amounts of records, which many people kind of maybe cuss under their breath or something. But it does allow you to do a lot of analysis in the off season, and so I know exactly how many row feet of squash I've planted every year I've been here. And I can tell you how many pounds I've harvested every year that I've been here. And we're seeing a definite upward trend.
Well, and I want to get off the topic of pollinators for just a moment and talk to you about organic certification, because we were talking with Doug Darrow a little while ago, and he's chosen not to go through certification. Your farm that you farm on has been in your family for a very long time. It was a conventional farm, and you have transitioned to organic. What was that process like?
The transition process, really for a fruit and vegetable grower, I think we have a little bit of a leg up on, say, a row crop operation, because we can, you know, we have more face time with our customers than maybe if you're selling, you know, transitional corn or soybeans, which are still conventional. So I think in that aspect, you know, we've had the marketing is a little bit easier in a vegetable operation. The biggest problem that we had really was just reintroducing biology into the soil, because most of those conventional corn and soybean fields are being sprayed with Roundup, which is a broad-spectrum antibiotic, and it really does kill off most of the microbial life, and especially the beneficial microbial life in the soil. And so just getting life back into the soil takes a number of years, really, no matter how you go about doing it.
Right, and that has less to do with the certification process than just making sure that your soil is healthy for growing.
Yeah, the certification process, people who are kind of scared by it or think that it is a lot of work, it is a lot of work, but the benefit really is there in that you have those records and that you're able to utilize those so you can make really informed decisions about how to move forward with your operation. And it does really, especially if you're going to sell into like a wholesale market or sell to grocery stores, it allows you to get your foot in the door a lot more easily. One of the first questions, like if you want to sell produce to Fairway, for example, or Hy-Vee, they're going to ask you, are you certified organic? That will be one of the first questions that they'll ask you as a new grower. And if you can say yes, it will allow you to have a further conversation.
So for you and for others that have pursued this path, the payoff sounds like it was worth it.
Definitely. I wouldn't do it any other way.
With observing the changes on the farm over the years, as you have increased the biodiversity, the microbial biodiversity in the soil, and of course with your different plantings and trying to attract pollinators, can you describe for me some of the changes that have been visible to you? You mentioned the greater production of squash because squash bugs are attracted to your place, but can you tell me what some of the other things you've seen change are?
Yeah, and the squash bugs I try to fight.
The
squash bees are
right.
So some of the changes we've put in after having gone to the Upper Midwest Organic Farming Conference, which is kind of a conference up in La Crosse, Wisconsin. That's in the winter. The Iowa Organic Conference is kind of it's a similar type conference right here in Iowa, so it's nice to have one closer. I've been hearing people from the Xerces Society speak about this for many years, so we installed some beetle banks, which are raised beds of native bunch grasses for predatory beetles, so not just for pollinators, but, you know, there are a lot of beetles that go out and eat pest insects, but you have to provide on-farm habitat for them. And as we've allowed those beetle banks to become established, we've seen more and more of these, like, black, really fast ground beetles that eat a lot of pest insects. And we're noticing that we maybe don't have to spray organically approved BT, for example, or organically approved, you can use organically approved pesticides. We don't have to do as much pest control because we have more of Mother Nature helping us out in that regard. Other changes that we've noticed, we have a lot more bird life, I feel, as we're not killing off all of the insect life, so there's quite a bit for them to eat. And, of course, we're not perfect in cleaning up our weeds, so there are some seeds for them to eat as well. And so it just feels like a richer environment when you walk out into it.
Sarah, I want to ask you, in your work with organic farmers, what do you find is the area where even organic farmers need the most education about attracting native bugs?
Yeah, one of the things in my work with organic farmers, so typically organic farmers are using cultivation for weed control. So they're not using herbicides, but they're using regular tillage. And knowing that about 70% of our native bees nest in the soil, and that a lot of our beneficial insects for pest control, like the ground beetles that Andy was mentioning, rely on some sort of undisturbed shelter in the ground or in litter spending their winter or spending part of the day. Knowing that, it can be really important on organic farms to try to bring in some areas of habitat that are not regularly disturbed by tillage. And so I'm working with a lot of growers who have expressed interest in not only planting habitat on the edges of their farms, so field border habitat, but also what we're calling insectary strips of habitat that are running right through the farm. And so those are areas that are sort of set aside, planted in flowers, planted in native grasses. They're not regularly disturbed. And they are serving to bring in habitat to the areas of the farm that are most in need of pollination and pest control services. So that's been sort of a neat approach that we've been taking on a lot of organic farms.
And Andy, from your perspective, knowing a lot of other organic growers, is there some resistance to this? Because it sounds like hard work, and it also sounds like it takes up ground that you could be planting in.
Yeah, I feel like there's been a pretty big shift in thinking amongst organic growers, having gone to conferences over the last 10 to 15 years, where I think the awareness level of what the beneficial insects do for us is such now that I don't think there is that much resistance anymore. And most people, like, the more you read about it and the more you get versed in it and the longer you're certified, the more you want to put this kind of habitat in, because you're on the ground and you're seeing some of those benefits. You know, like, I'm seeing more of the beneficial beetles now that we've installed the beetle banks, and we're seeing less pest pressure. And so the idea that, you know, it's a trade-off, really, it doesn't really exist. I think our yields are getting better on less ground, And by providing the habitat, we can actually be more profitable farming fewer acres.
As this organic conference is coming up, this is the 15th annual conference. And Andy, as I've watched the local foods movement grow, you were really one of the people on the forefront in Iowa. How have you seen the scene change over just even the last 5 years?
Some of the biggest changes, I would say, is that the number of farmers markets, I don't know if they're higher than they were 5 years ago, but they've changed maybe to more of an event as opposed to being in a farmers market. There's a lot more prepared foods. So it seems like the competition for customers' dollars at farmers market maybe has tightened a little bit. And so it seems that there are more and more producers that are wanting to sell directly to grocery stores as they have upped their produce game, I guess. So I'd say that's a trend that I've seen that's changed, in addition to seeing more of the food, like the co-ops, like the Iowa Valley Food Co-op in Cedar Rapids and Iowa City, and the Iowa Food Co-op in Des Moines. Those have really kind of taken off in the last 5 years as well.
And I mentioned much earlier in the show that the number of certified organic farms in Iowa continues to grow and at a fairly rapid rate, although I get the impression that there are even more farms that haven't gone through that certification process and are using some of these organic or sustainable practices. Is that your impression as well, that there are a lot more people getting into this than maybe we can count?
I think so. I think there are a number of people that are using at least some of the organic practices, but maybe not certifying. They do have to be quite aware, though, of how the organic rules and regs are written. And so if you're grossing over $5,000 and calling yourself organic but not certifying, you're actually breaking a federal law. People really need to kind of verse themselves in what how they're marketing themselves, because, you know, if you're saying that you're organic but you're planting, you know, conventional seed when organic seed is available, that would actually be breaking, you know, a rule or regulation of organic practices.
So as this kind of explodes, people also need to be careful and get educated. Andy, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yep, thanks for having me on, Charity.
Andy Dunham is the co-owner of Grinnell Heritage Farms. And Sarah, before I let you go, I want to ask you were talking about a pretty dire picture here in the beginning and thinking about native pollinators and their risk for extinction. What do you feel has to change to change that picture?
Well, I think habitat is a key ingredient, and that's a big part of what we do in the agricultural landscapes in the Midwest is, you know, working with growers to try to bring in more habitat. And also, I think changing farming practices to, trend towards systems that are less pesticide dependent. So doing things like Andy mentioned, cover cropping to improve soil health and plant health and maybe minimize the need to use insecticides in the first place. Things like tolerating small numbers of pests in recognition of the fact that if you want to build up populations of beneficial insects that feed on these pests, you need to have a little bit of something for them to feed on to get going. All sorts of strategies, crop rotation, selection of resistant varieties, just increasing whole farm diversity. So stepping away from monocultures and moving towards more diverse cropping systems.
There's a lot more education to be done. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Charity.
We've been talking about organic farming and production today on Talk of Iowa. The upcoming 15th annual organic conference is taking place November 22nd and 23rd in Iowa City. This is Talk of Iowa.